Hi, Diane.
Hi, Anne.
Hi. How are you?
Nice to meet you in a virtual fashion.
Yeah, nice to meet you.
It should be fun.
Yeah, okay. Well, we have a few things to talk. You thought it was a slow political week, didn't you?
I thought so, and I felt as though the sort of the whole last half of August, ever since the president went on vacation, or tried to go on vacation, seemed like it was going to be fairly slow. But surprise, surprise, even though the president went back to Camp David this week, news is trickling out about his health care plan. There's big news about the Recovery Act today. They're sort of trying to get back into gear before Congress gets back into session next week and school starts again.
Okay, so that makes me wary. That makes me think, oh, they're telling you, oh, nothing's going to happen. We're on vacation. Stop talking. Right. And then meanwhile, all of this stuff is going to go on and we'll be caught off guard. When, in fact, we have to be vigilant that they're going to spring this horrible law on us.
Well, the particulars of any law, particularly as it relates to health care, are still very much up in the air.
That's right. You never know what it is. It's a moving target.
Right. And part of the problem with the August recess and fighting for health care had to do with the fact that there were all these bills. There were three different bills from three different committees in the Congress that then lawmakers couldn't really pick one to defend or pick a stand, and so had to sort of catch as catch can throughout the month of August. Yeah. And now, even now, the president said, you know, and everyone knows this at this point, pretty highly anticipated speech, maybe the most important one of his presidency, is happening next Wednesday in front of a joint session of Congress, which never happens. But even that, you know, they've announced it, but I don't know that he'll know what he's going to say until he walks right up to the podium. So that's typical, I would say, Obama would try and rescue what's something that people would suggest has gotten out of his control with a big, awesome speech. But it does put a lot of a burden on him to be specific, to be very clear about what he's saying, how he's saying it, and if he's really going to. I mean, this is sort of it, right? We're down at the end.
Specific is a great word with respect to Obama, because he got elected president because he inspired people over complete abstractions, and people got into their own frame of mind about relating to him, and they liked him a lot, but they liked him over complete abstractions like hope and change.
Right.
Then when we find out what the particular changes are, you know, he's lost all of this ground in popularity. I think just because when we get to the actual specifics, we don't really agree. He was popular, but popular in the abstract. And then this healthcare has sprung on us as if we would be for it just because we liked him at the abstract level. But people got unabstract, and then there were never enough specifics to go along with this moving away from abstraction.
And now
he's trying to come to us and tell us, and it seems like a lot of times when he talked to us, he didn't really know what he was purporting to defend, that he was trying to stay on a more abstract level, and we still don't know what the specifics are. I think it's crazy that we've come this far and have argued about it so much and still don't particularly know what we're talking about, and he's still trying to sell it on his personality alone. I think that the whole idea has fallen apart over the summer.
Well, I would disagree with him not being specific. I mean, there's sort of I was at the press conference he gave specifically around healthcare earlier in July, and I have to say, the press corps walking out was like, well, that's kind of it was kind of boring. You know, he went on and on into the weeds, as he tends to do, and it's gotten a little bit better over time. But, you know, he's talking about, it reminds you of sort of Al Gore and, like, the lockbox, that persona. And I actually think that there's been a lack of specificity, and I'm currently sort of reporting and writing a piece about the moral case for healthcare reform and why it wasn't made earlier and why the White House decided to go with cost reduction, cost cutting, and the sort of what's in it for me argument instead of the, like, this is wrong, this should be done, we should, you know, help people.
Yeah.
And they didn't do that. They went into the sort of wonkery, and I think that that's helpful for people in Washington, but I don't know that it's affecting, you know, these folks who are at these town halls or people who are sort of casually supportive of the president, but don't know.
When they presented it as cost cutting, that led to the rationing and gonna unplug you and let's encourage people to die and all of those things, which really did lead into a
moral discussion. I don't think anyone needs encouragement to die. I feel like that happens.
Well, earlier, before, you know, encouraged to die, to leave, to save the system money, or just to be denied treatment because it's too expensive and you're not productive anymore. That led down to a moral path, and the moral argument on that side actually was strong. So the moral argument for health care wasn't particularly made. But then to make the argument in terms of saving money, it not only played into the hands of people who were saying, we don't want rationing sprung on us, but it also wasn't believable after the stimulus stimulus bill and after so much other money was spent, mm-hmm. these people just hadn't established themselves as money savers.
I know. It's tough because, you know, just today, and this would be, what, Thursday, Joe Biden is, you know, and a bunch of different cabinet ministers are going around the country talking about the Recovery Act and what it's done and over the 200 days that it's mm-hmm. been in effect. And it has been surprisingly effective in a number of different ways, specifically in the realm of education, I would say, where it's been an agency that's been starved for money and they know just what to do with it. In some other cases, you know, I've seen folks, when I've been out in Michigan, there was a young woman wearing a reflective vest and guiding traffic on a two-lane highway in some tiny town, and it was, like, paid for by the Recovery Act. I don't want to knock it. I'm glad this teenager has a job, but, you know, the efficacy can be debated. But in terms of the debate in Washington over healthcare, it's so interesting that they've gone with the economic argument on healthcare and not the sort of the moral argument mm-hmm. when on climate change, I think it's been very smart that they've, even though it's not a priority of theirs, and I doubt we'll see much happening out of Congress or the White House in general, they
have
made it more
about... Other than to take away our light bulbs, which is...
Well, they want to do a dollars and cents thing. Like, they've been very... It's not about tree-hugging, at least from where they stand.
Right.
And from a lot of these environmental activists have made a point of not talking about saving the whales, stopped calling it global warming, but have said this is going to save you money on those light bulbs.
Well,
or,
isn't a problem...
You know, by weatherizing your house or what have you. So it's the reverse strategy.
Yeah. I think that... Well, on the subject of I'm sorry, I lost my thread. Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
No, it's fine. I mean, it's you have to fight the fight that's in front of you with uh-huh. the tools you have. Uh-huh. I'm not sure the White House has overlearned 1993. And on healthcare and on climate change, they have strategies that seem mismatched to the actual task at hand.
On the subject of morality and health care, isn't a key problem there that the uninsured were not really very sympathetic, that the truly poor people did have a safety net, and that we're really talking about a bunch of people who are choosing to spend their money on – who are healthy and currently betting on their health and choosing not to spend their money on health insurance? They really aren't that sympathetic of people. And meanwhile, a lot of the people who are really sympathetic, they're covered by current safety net programs, and then there are a lot of people who are just productive people with good employment arrangements who have a lot of benefits that they want to keep and don't really want to share, don't really want to be leveled out with people who could be buying insurance and just aren't.
Right.
The moral argument really there to be made other than just everybody deserves health care, everyone should have health care, but if some people are working and getting something that they worked hard to get in their labor arrangements with their employers, to have those people be the losers and to have some people who are just lucky enough to be healthy and choosing not to spend their money on insurance, to have those people portrayed as if they're very sympathetic, maybe it just couldn't
right.
be done.
I mean, two things in response to that. One, I think it's sort of it's an easy trap to fall into, Anne, where you sort of think of people who are below the poverty line as the sort of the people who are really compelling, and you've used that language here. Mm-hmm. But what about somebody who, an income inequality in the United States in the last, let's say, decade, has mm-hmm. risen so steeply that it could be a family making between $60,000 and $80,000 a year, up to $90,000 a year, mm-hmm. that just isn't really able to cover their costs, that is the moral case here, the people who might be helped the most. And it's not, you know, a family on welfare with seven kids,
right.
The sort of caricature that people might put forward, but a regular, you know, people who maybe have contract work but no benefits.
And so then the
they're
question
money,
is, what,
but they're not
what,
covered.
Why aren't
that
they buying why aren't they buying their own health insurance? It hasn't been vividly portrayed to us why they can't do
right.
it. Now, I think there are some people who have problems of pre-existing conditions.
The point is, like, being sick and going bankrupt could happen to just about anybody, even if you have good health coverage. And I feel like that case, that's the reason why the White House and Congress, certain members of Congress, are pushing for a plan that covers as many people as possible. The latest information out suggests, you know, we might not even get to 40 million people covered. The scaled-back plan might cover 20 million people, which is half that. The question now is sort of, is that better than nothing? I think we'll get something.
But still, that answer, that fell away from being a response on the level of morality. You were saying, why wasn't the argument made in moral terms? And then when I presented a reason why I thought maybe it wasn't made in moral terms, that the ground wasn't there to build that argument on, you didn't respond for telling me why it was moral, but you made some more general economic arguments about why it would probably be good policy.
Well, I think people don't feel bad for families making $75,000 a year,
mm-hmm.
but they should. I think that's mm-hmm. my point. families who have contract workers who don't have benefits or benefits for themselves and not for their dependents, these are people who would be helped by a healthcare plan and who are currently suffering from high premiums, et cetera. If you're working, you go to work every day. You have a contract, but you don't have benefits. You know, how you don't have health insurance, and yet you're not under the poverty line. And so it's hard, I was trying to point out, to imagine those people as the moral, the people for whom, you know, it's not charity, but for whom we should feel as though we have a social responsibility.
I just think
we don't think of those people as the people we need to be helped.
I just think it wouldn't work as a that maybe the reason it wasn't done is that it wouldn't have worked as a moral argument to present them as sympathetic and needy. I understand economically why it's a problem, why you could make $70,000 or $80,000 a year and think you don't have it in your budget to buy insurance. But, you know, do I then get to sympathize with you? I might want to look over your whole budget and say, are you getting cable TV? What are you spending on clothes?
Right.
You know, before my tax money goes into it, I might want to, let me look at your whole budget. Why aren't you buying health insurance? If the reason is, I don't want to spend hundreds of dollars of that a month when we're all okay now, we're getting by well enough. We'd rather spend it on other things. What kind of vacations are you going on? I mean, how are we to have a moral argument like that?
I don't think it's that people are saying, I want a new pair of sneakers. I think health insurance is very expensive, and it's gotten more expensive as the cost of other things.
I know, but if you want to make a compelling moral argument to me about people like that, people that make that much money, how do you do it without showing me their budget and letting me look at real people and criticize their way of life? I mean, I just don't see how that argument would work very well.
Right.
I mean, even though I can basically be sympathetic to people who are managing a family budget, I think if you ask the taxpayers to share with those people when they have made provisions for themselves, that they're going to want to see the details, not just accept as an assertion, somebody making $70,000 with a family is going to have trouble buying insurance. It's going to
do
make people want
premise?
To see their whole budget.
Do you think that, I mean, I
it's not a moral argument. I accept it economically, but I don't see it as, you know, a moral issue of our age that those people
right.
have a budget
well,
problem.
Well, you know, this is
sort.
A difference of ideology, I suppose. During one of the debates last year during the presidential campaign, very clearly there was a question, do you believe healthcare is a right? Ted Kennedy would say yes, Barack Obama said yes without blinking, and John McCain said no. So there are differences of opinion about whether...
Well, do you think having a nutritious diet is a right? Do you think having a clean and safe, adequate shelter is a right?
Those are all commodities. You know what I'm saying?
These
health
are things people normally buy
for
themselves.
And health isn't a commodity, like a sandwich is a commodity. And I've tried to make this point before in Blogging Heads. I mean, it's not... You know, health is something separate and apart from regular goods. And so
I'm comparing it to other physical needs of the living human body, that you need medical care when you're sick. You don't necessarily need all your checkups paid for, though. You don't necessarily need... I mean, compared to things like clothing and shelter and food, there are a lot of basic needs that people have, and we don't... It would be very different to look to the government for all of those things. Medical care is one
right.
of those things.
But it's dysfunctional to look to employers and to insurance providers. I mean, that's just the only word
I
you can use.
I agree, but we've been working under that system
long. Yeah, it hasn't been very effective. Again, I point to the contract worker. I point to folks who are, because they're having to be offered benefits by their employer, they're missing out on wages. That's another
but you know
relevant
what? You,
point
you've
that I don't
done
think
it,
has been driven
You did it
home
again,
enough.
Though. You took it back into the economic policy problem as the way it was presented politically and away from the moral issue. You tried to get it into
moral
issue
finish,
by calling it
here,
a right.
Here's what I'm saying. An argument that would be effective along the lines of economics as opposed to morality, because I don't think this cost containment thing has been really a winner with the American people. But I think an argument that, look, because your employer has to provide you benefits, you're not taking money home. They would rather, I mean, you know, any individual, and I've talked to small business owners who say, look, you know, if I offered my employees, like, benefits or a raise, they would take the raise, right? But they have to be provided benefits because in America, health insurance is based upon your state of employment.
Yeah.
So people would be able to take the money that it costs monthly. My former employer was $286 a month to insure an individual, and that could be money that was paid to me every month. And I just don't think that case has been made effectively. So I didn't mean to suggest that that's a moral argument.
Yeah.
But just that that's one element of the discourse that hasn't been put forward.
My point is that you presented the idea that it should have been done as a moral argument, and then when I raised problems with the moral argument, you went back to the economic argument. So I think that reinforced that it was the better choice to present it economically, that the moral basis for the argument wasn't there. It was an economic argument.
I think people also aren't very aware of the income inequality in America. I mean, I think 17% of the country thinks they're in the top 1% of earners. People in America have no idea how rich some people are.
Yes,
and they have no idea how
rich.
Close to middle class or lower middle class they are.
The problem doesn't
so when,
exist
wait,
because
here,
some
hold on,
people...
one moment, Anne. There was a story, and I talked about this at some other point. There was a story in the New York Times where a guy who had studied, you know, the ins and outs of the healthcare plans, didn't really understand everything, but was interested in engaging, but made a comment that was something along the lines of, you know, we don't want those people to benefit. But what he didn't realize was he is those people. That's why the moral argument has flopped or might flop. People are insensitive to their own economic station in America in a way that George Bush and a lot of conservatives have managed to exploit over the years. But it doesn't nullify the fact that a lot of people would be helped by a robust universal health insurance plan. Think of it as something that only poor people or the disadvantaged or people who are of minority status or disadvantaged in some way will get. And so when you can't think of yourself as part of the collective that might benefit, you're not going to respond to a moral case. And I think, you know, a lot of the work that the president and the DNC and other groups have tried to do around faith, for example, that you take care of the least of these are arguments that have a little bit more traction in middle America, mainstream America, but from an economic perspective, which is intimately bound up in the moral case, unfortunately, sorry to disappoint you, people don't understand people don't like the idea of feeling like they need to be helped. That's what I'm saying.
I think most Americans, I think it's, wouldn't accept the idea that they have a station in life as opposed to that they are participants in a free market where they take responsibility for themselves and they can become successful if they work and they can bargain for better positions and so forth. And also the idea
that
some
joke
people,
is on
and
that.
Wait, let me make another point.
That's true.
And that, well, this is ideologically the difference between left and right, and you're stating the left position. I don't think Americans are as, I think and the Democrats are finding this out, Obama is finding this out, Americans are not as left-wing as the positions you've been stating. Another point is that you talk about the very rich. People don't understand income equality, and you bring up the point that some people are very rich. I don't think that most Americans are troubled. I mean, I think leftists are troubled by the fact that Americans aren't troubled by it, but I think most Americans aren't troubled by the fact that there are some very rich people. It's not.
Yes, but they don't understand how much richer than them those rich people are. That's what I was trying to illustrate with that statistic.
I think people don't think that's unfair. They think that the people who got rich figured out how to get rich. They hit it big, and that's part of the system that if you're entrepreneurial, if you take risks, if you do certain things, you can get ahead. And you can even. And some people will hit it really big. And if there's not a resentment for the ones who did manage to hit it really big. There's more a sense
of thinking, what can I do? That's oblique to the point I was making. I think you might be right. American individualism is a robust tradition in our politics and in our social civic psyche. The point I was making was very specific, germane to healthcare. Just that people don't realize that income inequality is so great that those people, those charity cases, for lack of a better word, who need healthcare, who need Medicare, who need Medicaid, those people are them. I don't think that that's something that resonates. People don't like to think of themselves as the people who would be the direct beneficiaries of a public health insurance system because they don't like to think of themselves as non-self-reliant, as we
discussed.
That's
right, and I would say, and is that a problem? I think that you're presenting it as
a problem.
I think it can also be presented as not a problem in that shows that people are self-reliant, that people do believe in this American tradition of a free market, of being responsible for yourself and so forth, and they're not willing to buy into the victim status, that you're condemned to your station, that there's a class that should be the basis of politics, which is the left-wing position. And if the health care bill is based on that kind of deep left-wing ideology, it really ought to fail, and it explains a lot of this vigorous opposition that we're getting in the public sphere, which, by the way, it should be mentioned that somebody had his finger bitten off in the last day. Apparently one of the anti-healthcare people got his finger bitten off by someone who was a pro-healthcare at some rally.
Right.
Finger bitten off.
I think that the conversation around healthcare hasn't nearly been worthy of the seriousness of the problem, as well as the necessity and the sort of social obligation to have a democratic discussion in a democratic society about an important issue. It just hasn't been worthy. The finger-biting example is one in a long line. the conversation that Americans have been having, and I don't know how many people are having regular kitchen table conversations or civil, you know, open houses at their churches, or all the congresspeople who didn't get heckled and didn't make national news. Mm-hmm. But from what we've seen, the guns at the events, the fingers being bitten off, some of the labor activists who have beaten up some of the right-wing folks, some of the right-wing folks who have said completely nonsensical, radical things, all of the conversation around the healthcare debate has been unfortunate, in my opinion.
And what do you
think? I think the president has a chance to do on Wednesday is to remind Congress, because, again, this is all about the theater of public opinion. And the theater of public opinion only matters insofar as it influences legislators. And I think, you know, absent all other aspects of the debate, I think the White House has been right to sort of ignore the noise all August of people and of all of this, all of these items that I've mentioned. Because what they're going to do now and what they continue to do all summer is meet with the Democratic caucus and the Republicans in this gang of six and try and get a deal done. Mm-hmm. Who cares what the guy whose finger bit the other dude's finger thinks? I mean, we like to delude ourselves into thinking that we're this participatory democracy. That's every 2 years, every 4 years, I guess, for most people. The rest of the time, Congress is making decisions about the well-being of American people. We can influence them by acting crazy at events or by writing letters or by being reasonable or by being unreasonable. But at the end of the day, it's, you know, Olympia Snow, it's Chuck Grassley, it's the folks who are in Congress
that have
been the problem.
Well, I mean, you called it the theater of public opinion.
Yeah.
They do respond. Now, they may get arrogant and think because they have the majority that they can just put through whatever they want in some big bill. And often it does work, but it didn't work at all this time. It really fell apart, and I think that they seem to be
what
at
fell
a loss
apart,
to regather.
What fell apart? Because you need to be specific. There's still a lot of paper, you know, with a lot of writing on it
that's trying to deal with healthcare. Well, let me say.
If you're talking about the public narrative, then that's different.
I think that what fell apart was the arrogant position that the people with the majority power in Congress could simply put what they wanted in a bill that, as Obama put it, I won, and that would go through, and that could be done. And I think people made enough of a stink over these changes or this unknown 1,000-page bill that attention needed to be paid, that there was a lot of loss of popularity points in the polls, and that does have an effect. Now, let me finish the thought. They were planning on being able to simply use the power that they'd won in the last election. And then when that got pulled apart and they needed to actually justify what they were doing, that they didn't really have a way to justify it. They didn't have a way to explain what they were doing. They didn't have a way to speak to people. And that caused a bigger response to that response. And now there's an attempt to backfill and make up for it. And I don't think there's any kind of a speech Obama can make. I think he is deluded, and the Democrats are deluded if they think the old magic of speech making and oratory is going to fix this and make people stop. I think that a political movement against the bill has started, and that it can't be shut out. And the whole message, please stop talking now, please be quiet now, we need to get something done, all the time for talking is over, I think that that's just an enraging message to people who are genuinely and properly worried about the law that's being the Democrats would like to dump on them.
Right. Well, I disagree with the idea that people, A, have an influence, B, know what's going on. That may be lowercase Republican of me, that may be elitist of me, but I think it's true for the vast majority of people who are against health care reform. I haven't really heard anyone on the Republican side articulate a counterproposal that makes any sense, and I still haven't sort of really heard from you or from anyone else the acknowledgement that there is a problem that needs to be fixed. Firstly, the Bush years were a time when majority rule was understood. Now they're sort of, you know, people like to dump on Democrats for being overly, for being spineless, actually, and not railroading through the kind of majority rule that you saw during the Bush years.
Mm-hmm.
All that being said, you know, I again discount the idea that this has anything to do with anyone other than Congress at this point. And so the address, fittingly, that Obama will give on Wednesday will be in Congress. special session. It doesn't happen often for a single issue. It's going to happen on Wednesday around healthcare. And, you know, behind the scenes, they're doing all the arm twisting they can do to get whatever bill, you know, and we don't even know what shape it'll take. So I don't want to speculate too much, but we're past the time when people, you know, everyone sort of weighed in, for better or worse.
So you're going to take the time to stop talking and get something done.
Yeah, no.
You know, and I'm on this, you asked me, will I admit there's a problem? Do I think something needs to be done? I think there are a lot of problems, but I resist solutions that I fear might be worse than problems. I think better leave the problem and figure it out or work on it incrementally than to suddenly just do something big that you think the problem deserves. I don't trust change like that. And I think people are genuinely afraid of it. I think it's an untried, worked out solution that has a very political character to it. And so you could say, yeah, I think there's a problem. That doesn't mean any solution might be better. Solutions often make things worse. And I don't think that it's thought out. Mm. I don't think they know what they're doing. And that they were attempting to put something through without really even knowing what it was. They were trying to vote on something that they didn't know what it was. Apparently,
that's still the case because there are three different bills, and there's a presidential plan that will be put forward, and all of these will be conferenced or reconciled into something that may very well approximate what you're calling an incrementalist approach, something that isn't whole hog, that covers, as I said, 20 million, not 40 million or 45, or the full 47 million uninsured. There's plenty of room for negotiation here. This is not an issue that either of us consider to be our specialty or that we focus on exclusively, but I would disagree with your idea that there's no incremental change or that there's no halfway solutions and that we should do nothing instead of something.
No, I just think that's not what I said. I said I think that there is a problem. I resist solutions just because there are problems. I think solutions can be worse. And that my approach to dealing with a problem, what I would prefer would be something that was more incremental. For example, fix Medicare first and see how that works. Do smaller things. Do things where there's more assurance that you know what you're doing. And then let some time pass and let the experiment prove that it worked before you do more things. And I don't think that's the Democrats' frame of mind.
You know, we have a lot of different templates for how to do this. And I think, you know, We'll see. I mean, I sort of want to table the issue just because we are dealing with so many different
issues. Well, on the subject of Obama speeches, I thought we should talk a little about this proposed speech to the school children.
Right.
On Monday. There's been a lot of criticism.
I don't have any kids, but I talked to a few editors around here who are excited their kids are back in school. They were like, got those buggers out of the house. Great. So, school is about to start again. And the president...
He's going to address them, and then the teachers are supposed to engage the students in little writing exercises, such as what ideas and actions.
How can I help the president?
Are we able to do what president is asking us to do? What do you think the president wants us to do? Now, I think it's been a little bit caricatured in the criticisms where it seems like they're saying that the children are supposed to figure out what can I do to help the president?
What can I do to help Barack Obama?
And I'm looking at the teaching guide, the official teaching guide, and I think it could be more teaching critical thinking, which is what I support with kids. Listen to a speech, learn how to understand what it is. Think about one of the questions is, what would you like to tell the president? What is he asking us to do? And should we do that? I think you could impose a lot more critical thinking in that. I don't really trust school teachers to do that. Number one, just because how advanced can elementary school kids be? But also because I think that the teachers, by and large, will really support and idealize Obama and are not going to use as an object of criticism.
Why do you think teachers idealize Obama? I mean, this is a nationwide effort.
I think teachers tend to be quite liberal on the political scale, and I think that there's a lot of adoring support for Obama that isn't at all about critical thinking. And I think when you're talking about little children, there's so little critical thinking that's taught to kids that age. I mean, I wish there were a lot more, but I don't really think that that's what teachers tend to do,
right.
Especially around political issues. For example, the way Al Gore's movie was used in schools, students were shown An Inconvenient Truth over and over again. It was all very much about inculcating certain values in students, not in teaching them to figure out where the gaps in the argument are and how to be critical. I mean, I think that's what children deserve, to really be educated, to learn how to think for themselves, to reason, to see logical fallacies, to have questions about gaps in the evidence. I would like to see students be taught that, to have a political speech made to the students. What that should be used, if it's going to be something that is in the educational environment and students are compelled to be educated, and these are public schools, I think if something like that is going to be done, it should be used the way students learn how to read properly, learn how to understand ideas, learn how to see rhetoric for rhetoric, understand how political arguments are made, and imagine someone who was on the other side. What would the speech on the other side be? Things like that that are really capacitating students to be real citizens who can participate in a political environment, not passive subjects of a president's manipulations.
Well, I've never, you know, two things on this front. I think the first point is that there's a long tradition of, you know, indoctrinating or inculcating, to use a nicer word, students with, we won't even need to call it propaganda, but with, like, messaging from the national government. The Pledge of Allegiance would be one specific example. I don't think that this is, I mean, I'm not trying to defend the weird, I find it frankly weird that there would be something like, now it's Help the President Hour in every public school in America. And the White House has walked back some of their language surrounding this particular issue just because it's contentious. But I don't see how that's different from a sort of like ask not kind of discussion that we had in the 1960s, you know, with JFK making a pronouncement that service is important. I think the president has also made the point that service is important. And I think that he's trying to put his finger on the scale in terms of higher education, certainly encouraging students to go to community colleges, and encouraging students who do some sort of government service to have money for college. I mean, these are things, this is education policy from the federal government, and I think you're allowed to have an intervention. I think you're right to emphasize that, you know, rhetoric, civil, people used to call it civic, social science, all of that's very important. It's nothing to say that none of that is happening in these schools. I just can't really get myself riled up about something that's like, you know, I don't even know how old these kids are, fourth, fifth grade. Like, I just can't get worked up about them writing something about helping the federal government or helping the president. I think that that's perfectly harmless.
I think people should learn to see themselves as separate from the government and to have a critical eye. And I don't think school time and compulsory schooling
Are you against the Pledge of Allegiance?
I don't think the Pledge... I've
never had to say it. I didn't go to public school,
yeah,
but I find it to be weird, like deeply weird. I
think it is deeply weird. I think it's, if you go to the Supreme Court cases that are about the subject, obviously you have the right not to say the Pledge of Allegiance. That's established as a matter of First Amendment law. If you go to those cases, the original case that said, in fact, the students could be forced, that's Gobitis. In the Gobitis case, where Justice Frankfurter wrote the opinion approving of requiring the students to say the Pledge of Allegiance, he didn't think it was good policy. He just didn't think there was a right against it, and he portrayed having students say the pledge as something that's about teaching students to be patriotic, but it's really short-circuiting that. It's just having them attest that they have patriotism, and that really isn't the best way to do it. But So I think even those who thought there wasn't a right not to say the pledge thought that, in fact, it wasn't the best way to get students to be patriotic. But I think a lot of schooling really is about inculcating patriotism. It's not I don't actually think that is the best thing to do. I think that in a democracy, what we ought to be trying to do is get the students educated to the point where they'll be good participators in the democracy, and that'll make the government better.
I think
if you just make
Obama's
the students
doing.
Feel
I think that's very
subservient
much
to government,
where his education
they're not
policy
going to
is
be
directed.
Good citizens. I haven't heard a speech. I don't know what he's going to say. I mean, perhaps it's going to be just along the lines of, hi, I'm the president, and I care about you, and I hope you'll study hard in school, and your teachers are good people, and they want to help you, so I hope you stay in school, or whatever he might say. Might be just pap, and in which case it's a waste of time. I mean, you know how you are when you're a teacher, and the principal keeps coming on over the PA system with messages and just butting into your time, usually with nothing. So if it's just PAP, it's still a waste of time. It's still an intrusion on the teachers. And the whole thing of the face of the president being projected into the classroom so that you will look on respectfully and know that the leader cares about you. I don't think that's particularly American.
I feel like that's fairly traditional. I mean, I'm not like real psyched about it, but that seems pretty traditional to me. It seems like, you know, that's something that I'm not, you know, someone who follows the role of presidents intervening in the day-to-day lives of American students, but it seems like we have a pretty decent tradition of paying attention to, or at least, you know, acknowledging the importance and role of the presidency. But I think that what you're saying about American education is sort of very much what Barack Obama wants to happen with American education, where you're talking about engaging kids so that they want to be part of society and engage. I mean, I think that there are not just rhetoric surrounding it, but actual policies that sort of are geared towards getting children to be type of American citizen. And I think that, you know, I've outlined them. I think, you know, I don't know, I'm not an education policy wonk or a schools watcher, but I do know that when it comes to higher education and secondary and tertiary education, the president has been a very, very robust proponent of having service and a certain, you know, renewed sense of patriotism and service to America, whether it's military, whether it's civilian, even in terms of education, that's been a big part of his platform. There's also, I am not an education policy expert or anything, but I read a fascinating piece in the New Yorker recently about schools. And my friend Dana Goldstein, who definitely covers education issues, pointed out that the type of teacher in these schools that is, there's just a lot of teachers that don't necessarily need to be given the benefit of the doubt, liberal, conservative, what have you. We have a problem in a certain sense with sort of over-trusting certain teachers to do the best they can with their kids. And so that reform movement is something that hasn't necessarily endeared teachers to the president, just to refer back to your first point about this. But again, I don't think, you know, either of us really follow this issue too closely.
Well, there's a big
I'm not worried about brainwashing.
There's a big difference between the president talking to the children and the president having policies that relate to the children. The second thing is better, although I have some problems with that. I don't think education really is on the list of federal powers. I think it's been taken over from the states, and it's inappropriate. And I would disagree with Bush about
George
that, too.
George Bush did that.
As I just said, I disagree with George Bush doing that, too. I don't think it's what the president should be doing. And I think that going into the classroom on the TVs and having students listen to the leader is not in the best American tradition. I don't think it's where we want to go, even if he means well. I assume he means well, but I often think just the way principals come in over the PA system when teachers are trying to teach, I think leaders sometimes have an inflated idea of just the sound of their own voice and how much they're doing for people. I don't think children should be subjected to speeches. Children are made to go to school. We have compulsory education. There are ways to opt out of it, but they're not that easy. And many children are just forced into the public school system. And I think adults, including the president and all the teachers, should have a much stronger sense of what they owe the kids that they are trapping in schoolrooms and subjecting to things. So I would not impose politician speeches on children, ever, unless it was the way you would give them a text and ask them to learn to understand it and to be critical of it, the way we might give a speech
I think an American history course is going to have rhetoric from presidents past and potentially present in it. I mean, I think that's part of, I mean,
but not for the purpose of following and adoring the president, but for the purpose of understanding what political behavior is and becoming a clear and independent thinker. The children need to be respected as individual human beings and not as tools of the government and not as people to be manipulated and inculcated. Education should be about that, and that if you want to talk about a moral issue, I think it is immoral to force children to go to school, to trap them when they really should be running around and exercising and doing healthy things, to trap them in a room and subject them to things. Whatever you're subjecting them to ought to be awfully damned good. Or I think that is a child abuse. And I think that So I guess I do object to the basic idea of the president of the country beaming himself into all the classrooms just to talk to the children, to make them sit there and watch television and listen to what's being said, unless there's some very strong critical thinking exercise that is being done there. And I don't believe that it really is going to be what happened.
Yeah, no, I mean, I accept your opinion as valid. I think that's fair. I'm not, you know, I don't feel particularly strongly one way or another about this issue. I did a piece recently about some kids, very, like, interesting elementary school kids who decided to take matters into their own hands in their school in New Orleans, mm-hmm. got their school lunches changed, got them, you know, healthier food, got rid of plastic silverware, mm-hmm. plasticware. So I think that there is an interesting development in the field of, you know, youth pedagogy for youth and how to best engage them. I think that Arne Duncan, who's the president's education secretary, has had a lot of experience around those issues in Chicago, and we'll just see. I mean, they're right now straddling the line between an outright union-busting reform strategy, which you've seen in Washington, uh-huh. D.C., and something that is just encouraging, and one might even use the verb coddling, teachers who are ineffective. So uh-huh. I guess the verdict is out, but I'm very interested, and I will be at that speech on Tuesday to see what the president says to open the school year. And that actually, just to segue slightly,
yeah.
I've been following, and maybe not as closely as you are, but this is a little bit of a hypothetical, the mm-hmm. issue of Bob McDonnell, who's running for governor in Virginia. He's a Republican candidate.
Yeah, I haven't followed that at all. So you have to just instruct me what the subject is, because I know there's something about something anti-feminist that he wrote many years ago. Was that it?
Right. Well, he wrote it when he was in school, no doubt under the influence of some liberal teacher. His master's thesis has what I would use the word retrograde views about women. He spoke about women in the workplace as sort of degrading the home and the family life, and it's a fairly standard, I mean...
And how long ago was it?
Years ago, even 10 years ago. This was in, I think, 92.
And is there some argument that he was doing this to kind of satisfy the point of view of a particular teacher, or he was actually going against
the teacher? No. This was his thesis. I mean, this was something that he researched and he wrote over the course of his graduate study, and... Uh-huh. has only now sort of surfaced
this is a PhD
in the middle
thesis?
Of a competitive race for governor. Pardon?
This is a PhD thesis?
This is a master's thesis. This is a master's thesis.
So he was pretty old.
So the question becomes, how far back and how important are... sorry, my phone keeps ringing. It's very annoying. How important is the academic work of an individual? How long can we hold someone accountable, et cetera, et cetera?
There was a lot about something that Hillary Clinton had written that had been a thesis of hers that had been kind of locked up at her college, something she'd written about Solomonsky or something. Mm-hmm. No, Michelle Obama, too, but Michelle Obama won't run for anything. But Hillary Clinton had something that she had written about Solomonsky, right? And that was not available
and
to be looked at.
Right.
And there was an argument that we shouldn't be able to see that. But the school was playing along there and holding it back. I don't know if we ever got to see that or not. And there was also a lot of stuff about Michelle Obama, but she wasn't the candidate.
Right.
But
essentially
I don't see any
on
reason
the ground,
why we shouldn't look at something he wrote. We're trying to understand the mind of a person. And these are things that he wrote. They're things that relate to the political issue. I don't see the problem at all with using it.
Right. Well, what's happening is people are discussing the issue. I mean, essentially, the Virginia Democratic Party has been basically wallpapering the state with this information. They've got a lot of female surrogates out there saying that this guy, Bob McDonnell, is a caveman and that he's sort of, you know, not right for Virginia, mm-hmm. which is a fair case to make. Republican Party, the Republican Party is crying foul. They're saying his views have changed over the years, you know, that he
is there any evidence
didn't really
that
mean
his
what
views
he said.
Have changed? Does he have anything to back that up? Or I mean, how are we supposed to know what anybody thinks?
He's got his female friends, you know, are sort of coming forward and saying we vouch for him. Mm. He totally loves women. He was misguided, et cetera, et cetera. What strikes me as hypocritical, particularly on that issue, is how willing Republicans were to crucify or attempt to or to focus on literally two words made during a speech by Sonia Sotomayor. That was not as, well, more recent than this McDonald's.
Not a speech, multiple
document.
Speeches.
She
a whole said speech. It over and over.
But it's just interesting to see how, you know, you can sort of pick and choose what parts about an individual's past are important to political office.
I think if you're the opponent, you should go ahead and say it and let them fight back with whatever they have and see if they can be persuasive. I mean, right. I think just having some of your women friends vouch for you, I think, is the lamest right. argument that anti-feminists and people accused of anti-feminism have ever made. I mean, I can tell you stories of, like, professors who had written something anti-feminist, and they would say things like, I'm not an anti-feminist. My wife tells me so. My wife,
the Silda Wall-Spitzer syndrome.
Everyone has women friends. And your friends yeah. support you. They want you
to. I mean,
to
it's like pointing to a black friend. Like, I have black friends. Look, like, it's very silly. But the point, just to be a little bit contrarian here, and because I really do feel this, is it really fair to judge somebody based on an academic article that was written many years ago?
I think,
would we judge someone for... think about Jon Favreau, the speechwriter for the president, groping a cutout of Hillary Clinton. He's still working. He's working on that speech for healthcare right now. About all the people who have creepy MySpace pictures or Facebook pictures? What about the folks who, like George Bush and like the president right now, did drugs in the past?
I think
my inclination is to want to give people the benefit of the doubt.
My inclination
is sort of distasteful. You see how we're talking about freedoms here.
Yeah. What I would do is, as with any evidence, some evidence is completely irrelevant, but a lot of evidence, including everything you've just mentioned, I think, has some relevance. It has some weight. And so the question is for the people who are making up their minds to look at the evidence and give it the weight that it deserves. Maybe it deserves some weight, but not too much. It's not like, oh, you shouldn't have even brought up. It was wrong to brought up. Like at a trial where you would say that evidence is excluded entirely.
Do you think standards are changing?
I think the better answer is to admit it, make an argument about why it should weigh more or less, and let the decision makers decide what weight to give it as weight against other things that are properly valued.
Right.
That's how decision making is done. I think it's a side issue to get into a big argument about mentioning it at all, unless you're trying to generate evidence against the other side, which is what a bad person they were even to talk about it. He did something when he committed a crime, or he was
Chappaquiddick.
He drove
There's
drunk
another
when
example.
He was 20. He was
right.
Teddy Kennedy was pretty old when he did that, and he did an awful lot of terrible things. I think if you really read the details of what he did, it's hard not to come away from that feeling just thoroughly appalled at the character of the man. The fact that he survived.
Well, I just wonder whether, do you think our mores are shifting? Because certainly for my generation, I can't think of someone who I know who doesn't have some shady nonsense that I personally know about. That is not going to be, that might run for office, might present themselves as the head of a board, the administration. Peter Baker wrote a piece a couple of weeks back talking about how only 43% of the positions in the administration have been filled because of this vetting that's been sort of hyper-vigilant. Is there a point where, as a society, we're going to have to stop penalizing people dated sort of puritanical mores,
we're
just not going to have any leaders?
I think people need to be smart enough to weigh things for what they're worth. And so, for example, I think that there's certain things that the kind of people with the personality to be politicians have probably done some bad things in their lives. I think a lot of the men have done things with women that if you were really strict, you would just write them off. For doing that.
Right.
Bill Clinton should have been absolutely rejected by the feminists. Teddy Kennedy should have been absolutely rejected by decent-thinking people. But they weren't.
And yet they weren't.
It was way...
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think voters making a decision... Of course, the cutoff point is Election Day, to answer that question.
Right.
When we're talking about vetting people, there's a separate problem there because you need to people these offices, and if you can never approve of anybody, you've got something seriously dysfunctional.
Right.
So that's a separate problem. But as far as elections...
I'm against all the judginess. I'm sorry. I just have to be. I find it
fundamentally illiberal. I would
and
frame
also,
that in terms of give the proper weight to each piece of evidence. So let's say the president seems to have admitted to using some cocaine, and apparently George Bush, there were rumors about George Bush. Some of it is, I'm not sure if it's true, so I don't know how much to count. It has some effect on your mind.
Right.
And I think ideally we should try to be sharp thinkers who don't freak out because, you have to be pure. And so somebody who's never done anything wrong is better than somebody who has a lot of good points but did a couple things wrong. I don't think that's the way we would choose our leaders. I think somebody that's never done anything wrong is probably too much of a goody two-shoes, or maybe he's not You know, he just hasn't done it yet, and he's going to bust loose someday. I don't know. I think that most of us have done some things wrong. A lot of people have used some drugs or had some substance issues in their lives at some point in their past. And it's a matter of looking at exactly what it was and giving it the weight that it deserves. I don't like the kind of going to the meta level of saying, let's all stop being judgmental about things that Puritans get upset about. I think the sexual
We can be mad about David Vitter, we can be mad about Larry Craig, we can be mad about William Jefferson, we can be mad about Elliot Spitzer, we can be mad about John Edwards. I mean, the list goes on and on.
Yeah, I would let Spitzer, might be coming back. I would let Spitzer. If Spitzer wants to run for the Senate.
I just hope that the women don't have to stand by the men. That's the one stipulation. If we're going to be all bygones, then the women shouldn't have to stand there and suck it up. And I admire Jenny Sanford in South Carolina for saying, I'm out of here. But I do think that, look, you know, society's mores are really different. I know that we chatted a little bit about this, but you don't watch Mad Men. The gender roles there are just sort of, you know, shocking, I guess, is the only word. And it's voyeuristic and pornographic in that sense, because you can see these men ogling these women and treating them disrespectfully, being sort of like casually homophobic, casually sexist, casually racist.
I don't need to watch Mad Men.
Those wars are all very different.
I don't need to watch Mad Men to understand that. I'm 58 years old. I lived through that.
Right.
I've had my entire life, my personal career. I can't tell you, I don't want to burden you with all the details right now, but I lived through that era, and I was impeded in my own personal progress, career-wise, by many things like that, and I don't really need to sit around and watch some recreation of it by people who didn't live through it. Although maybe the fashions and the interior design is interesting, I don't need to see that. I really know what that was, and I was personally injured by it. So,
How do you think that gender roles are different now? I mean, that's something that. There's been this sort of revival of this Kay Heimowitz piece in the City Journal about the relationship between men and women.
Yeah, why did that come back up?
Because
it was totally trashed last year.
Will Wilkinson.
Suddenly, did he know it was a year old when he wrote that?
I think it was
August and it was
maybe
really
he did. I actually don't know. But I think the response to the original article, which was about, you know, single young men and their boorishness, the response really struck a nerve among young women that I know who understand what it's like to be professionals in a sort of unstable relational paradigm where you're not really sure. It was about picking up the check and holding the door and all of that.
I thought it was about this idea that there were people who were learning how to have something called game that really was about going into a bar and actually being treating women abusively as a way that if you did it
they
would want to go home with you.
Will's response was really thoughtful insofar as he, one, complicated the idea of stable gender dynamics and said that he sort of would emulate and look toward and admired homosexual men who seemed to have a different style and a different way of carrying themselves that he admired, which is something that the exact opposite of the syndrome that Kay Heimowitz described. But further, he talked about partnership. I know that you were recently married, and the idea that, you know, you're not really just picking a husband or wife because those are gendered categories that are dated and relate to the idea of gifting women that, you know, is centuries old but still backward. Mm-hmm. But the idea of developing a partner and a capable cohabitant of the world for a long time, I think was something that really resonated with a lot of women who have trouble fitting the idea of wifeliness into the idea the tradition. I don't know. How do you think these things have changed over time?
Well, I mean, it seems like these are all younger people that I don't relate to that much. I mean, I was born in 1951. As I said, I'm 58 years old. I don't really. Well,
what did you expect when you got married?
I don't really have a history of dating. I was married in 1973, and my husband and I separated in 1986, so there was really more than a 20-year period where I didn't have a partner, and I was very strong on feminist values, and I really didn't think I would remarry. I didn't want to do that. I just haven't been through these things that are being described there, so I don't know if I'm a good example. I'm a good example of someone who went 20 years without a partner, if you want to talk about that. And the only reason I have a husband now is because an extraordinary person was able to get in touch with me and reach me.
Right.
And I just don't think that's the
normal
process.
What do you expect?
And it's a very lengthy
process.
So, ladies, if you're going to wait until someone comes to you from out of the, you know,
the internet,
you don't want to really wait that long. But I was really a committed single person, and I did not want a man in my, I mean, all of this gender inequality, I absolutely wouldn't do it. I have for a long time thought, and this is sort of a witticism of mine that I've used to keep my spirits up over the years, that better than nothing is a very high standard.
Right. That's interesting. So, you know, your expectations for marriage in a modern age are different simply because of our age differences, but I can't imagine that they're that different. In terms of expecting parity, expecting, you know, not to get...
Not just expecting it, but I just wouldn't do that.
Not to get
myself
choked in the middle of the night.
Yeah, I mean,
or beaten.
I don't know what people are talking
about
there. I don't know what people are doing there with these... to me, I was very stable as a single person, and I didn't go in for these abusive relationships. I don't understand why... I mean, I do understand why people would do it, why women would do it, but... But geez, what's the subject for debate? I don't even understand what it is. Obviously, if you marry, you have to have a good relationship. There needs to be equality. I think there are different kinds of equality, and I think there are relationships where people have certain kinds of roles, and they may be traditional gender roles, just out of that being your preference, or you may enjoy that on some deep physical animal level that we've evolved to have. And I don't think there's, and I think it's a mistake to feel that there's something wrong with having a relationship that falls into the traditional gender roles. You make your idea of what's satisfying and what's equal, and you do that if it's good. And don't do it at all if it's not good. I think that these
political
ideas about equality and parity and gender, whatever, and being concerned about gender difference, well, we do have gender difference at a biological level,
right,
and that's part of our sexuality. And if you want to try to eradicate that, you might ruin your sex life. So I would say think very hard about what you particularly want, what's satisfying to you, and it's not politics.
Yeah.
It's personal.
Yeah, I guess I think Will's post just sort of clarified for me the difficulties that men have in establishing their relationship to their gender and to the world, just like women do. And I think that's a more recent development, which is, you know, encouraging, I guess. Let's all just sort of be down there struggling in the muck. Well, it's been, we're getting up on an hour. It's been super fun to chit-chat.
Okay.
We made the most out of what was a slow news week.
Oh, this always
I think this has been a great conversation.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the possible, they're saying, retirement of Justice Stevens. I just wanted to throw out there the idea that if and when Stevens retires, if he's the next one to retire, that will mean there isn't a single Protestant on the court. There will be six Catholics, two Jews, and then the open seat. And I just think, I wonder if the religious diversity on the court is something that will be talked about openly. I'm talking about it. I do think it will influence Obama. I think it's a really strange, I mean, we are concerned with diversity, and that is a real weird lack of diversity
in terms of
It's
complicated because
the,
we're not supposed to take these things into account.
People don't want to talk about religion. Yeah, but I think religion is important because that's another thing that is about your mind. We're talking about someone who will make decisions. We want to know something. We want some diversity in the kinds of minds that are making these decisions. So I think to have...
I just feel as though people no longer think that religion can have an overbearing effect on your political beliefs. That's clearly not true, not
but
in a domestic political
sphere. It's not political.
Ever since Kennedy gave his speech when he was running for president about how the Pope wasn't going to run the country, I think people have sort of given... And again, Catholicism is so different from state to state, from generation to generation, from country to country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have people who are angry that, you know, that some cardinal went to Ted Kennedy's funeral because Ted Kennedy is a supporter of abortion rights.
Mm-hmm.
Suna Sotomayor, who presumably is pro-choice, is on the court, just as well as Nino Scalia, who is very much anti-abortion. So seeing that spectrum of diversity is almost helpful.
Well, should we be concerned
in decoupling the idea of religion from politics?
Well, should we be concerned with diversity on the Supreme Court or not? And if we're concerned with diversity, why not religious diversity? Why is religion special for being excluded from the public discourse? But it's not excluded. It's just excluded when we want to exclude it. But it's not completely excluded.
Right,
and I don't think it should be.
I think that people feel as though it cannot, it would not govern as a sort of prevailing reality or factor that might affect judicial decision making. And I think that that's something that is hypocritical, probably, of the American people to believe, but they do nevertheless. I mean, certainly we've seen like political movements start and stop on the heels of religiosity. Terri Schiavo is a good example. But I don't feel as though, I think the diversity within the Catholic members of the Supreme Court underscores the fact that these things don't necessarily determine any more than your skin color or any more than your hair color what you're going to think.
Well, I think that there was an argument when Sotomayor went up about the importance of having women or having a Hispanic person on the court. There's an idea that people have different backgrounds. And, of course,
right.
Some people think, well, everyone thinks the same, but then there are arguments about that. Do we care about diversity factors, or do we think a judge is really deciding things based on the text, based on abstract reasoning and so forth, or is
right.
there something that people bring to the task of interpreting texts that comes from their background experiences? And if we're going to do that, then why wouldn't religion be one of those things? It's another background
well,
experience.
Isn't,
it's
okay,
something
so you're,
that you
you're
bring
a lawyer,
into the discussion.
And I'm not.
Yeah.
But there are different levels of scrutiny for different classifications that are
mm-hmm.
suspect, right? Racism is under strict
yeah.
scrutiny,
yeah. Yeah.
right? And religion, you know, that's under Title VII, but it's sort of a big catch-all. Creed, age, whatever.
But you can't.
It seems to be something that people are less concerned about.
No, you can't. There's strict scrutiny for discrimination based on religion. You can't. In fact, there's in the original Constitution, there is a provision for no religious test for any office.
Right.
And then there's also the Establishment Clause, which has an effect there, and the Free Exercise Clause. So this it's usually done not with equal protection, but with free exercise and establishment. And there's an
right.
idea that you have to treat people neutral as to religion. Oh, well, that's fine. So
right.
that all of those things seem to go for saying, let's not talk about it at all. But then we do talk about race and sex when we talk about an individual candidate for the court. And when the president makes his individual selection, we don't say, well, we think he probably picked Sonia Sotomayor because of her ethnic group or because of her sex, and therefore he's saying he's not allowed to do that. We did,
right.
In fact, encourage him to do that, that was a good thing to have diversity. Now, some people are completely anti-diversity, and they don't like that at all. But if you're going to be someone, and clearly Obama is, that takes diversity into account. I just think that the religious diversity is another diversity factor, whether we feel free to openly talk about it or not.
Yeah, I think that you're right. I think that's fair. I mean, I think that your religion and the way that you're brought up, whether it's in the church or in another faith tradition,
mm-hmm.
Will have some effect. But I would just say that, I mean, I think, you know, if you look at the expression of genes on any different chromosome, there are some genes that are dominant, there are some genes that prevail. I feel like gender and ethnicity, for lack of a better metaphor, express themselves in a more powerful way than religion. And I don't know whether that's
Because religion is so cultural. I think that
I mean, it is dogmatic in certain cases, but it's more cultural the way it's lived.
Well,
as
religion
all the different
is very much about your upbringing. It's also about a lot of your of styles of
right.
reasoning, styles of thinking about what a text means. It's done differently by Protestants and Catholics, and that could be
yes,
carried
precisely.
Directly into constitutional interpretation. People have talked about that. We're talking about the way a person thinks. Religion is about, first of all, how you were brought up, and also your habits of mind, the way you think. And I think it's more likely that a judge would bring that into the legal reasoning process than their sex or their race.
I think that that might be true for a different generation. I don't know how many people. I mean, I went to Sunday school as a kid. You know, people certainly have different levels of academic understanding of their faith and of texts and of dogma.
Mm-hmm.
But given the fact that we have all these different members of the Catholic faith on the court now, I think that's sort of evidence for the fact that the things that we sort of think about when we think about them are their political stances, their ethnic upbringing, their geographical diversity, their gender diversity, more than their religious affiliation, perhaps because we think religion is less powerful in its application to lawmaking, probably because we have this supposed division between church and state, whereas, and it is hypocritical, as you rightly point out, to have a sphere of domestic politics that are still so bound up in questions of religion and religious faith and the expression thereof. Yeah. But it's not something I lose sleep over, to be honest.
You know, this ties back to the original topic, which was the morality of the policymaking about health care. Mm-hmm. And Obama himself had this big conference call to all these religious leaders, and he tried to present government policy making with a religious tone. And so there's always some of that going on. And thinking about policy, morality and policy and all kinds of ideas, for many people, thinking in the religious mode is the way they do it. So I think the idea that we should be able to section that off and have that just be our religious life is something that some people can do, usually people that aren't that religious, but or people that have a minority religion that they know wouldn't play that well if they brought it up in public. But I do think that religion is a big part of the way people think, at least.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. We'll have to see. I mean, Stevens, it's only a rumor. He's only hired one clerk for the next term, and we'll just see whether we get another vacancy.
Yeah.
I think, you know, President Obama has a legitimate opportunity to change the direction of the courts for a very long time, and that is something that shouldn't be taken lightly.
So what would you advise him to do? Do you think he should be picking another woman? Do you think there should be another black person on the court?
Well, I'm not, a scholar of law. I guess, the people whose names, Cheryl and Eiffel wrote a piece for us recommending Elena Kagan, who would be, someone who is smart, someone who the president trusts and knows from Harvard Law School, and someone who does bring gender diversity to the court. I think there are a lot of other people who will continue to surface on different short lists. Sotomayor has been on a short list since, the late 90s. So it'll be someone that's not a stranger to us, and we'll just have to wait and see. But I don't know that I'm qualified to really say.
No, it's okay. But, when he makes an appointment, he's doing it in the political sphere, too. He's doing it with an eye toward his political credit, and so it does.
Yeah.
The way it impacts ordinary people or non-lawyers, I'm not saying the non-lawyers, it really does matter. There's always Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
Do you think it's time for her to be moved out of the State Department and squirreled away in the Supreme Court?
No. Only because of a hilarious line that Clarence Thomas, who's 20 years old? I don't know. I feel like Hillary Clinton is a fantastic mind. She's brilliant. She's been doing a gangbuster job at the State Department to very little glory, at least domestically. Everywhere she goes, she's treated like a hero in this front page news. But Hillary Clinton is 60.
She's too old.
You need a 15-year-old.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I
think her character would be attacked, and that she shouldn't even be willing to put up with that. I've said that before on Blogging Heads, but yeah. Anyway.
I'm forgetting what the anecdote about Clarence Thomas is, but it's pretty funny. It's about his cholesterol. Maybe people can Google that and figure it out.
Oh,
but he's no.
They want to leave their mark. They want the person to stay a long time. And Justice Stevens is 89. So, maybe he's trying to hit the 90 mark and then set some records. But, there is a thing of trying to get somebody young.
There will be plenty of time to stew over the next appointment.
Yeah.
Not if, but when it happens.
Yeah.
But it was a pleasure to speak with you, Anne.
It was
a very interesting conversation.
Okay.
I will catch up with you soon.
Okay.
Take care, everybody, until the next time.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.